From WBUR Boston, I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. New York's boss Tweed was big, brash, and bold. He stood 6 feet tall and weighed 300 pounds. A 10.5-carat diamond decorated his shirt front. He spent the city's money liberally on the poor, on big public works projects, and on himself and on his ring. He kept the city's coffers full by issuing more and more debt, sending the city toward bankruptcy. William Tweed had a flair that is seldom seen in politicians today. He had the money to keep his friends loyal, but those friends were as motivated by power and greed as Tweed was himself. And when the political wind shifted and reformers took control of the city's coffers, Tweed's powerhouse collapsed. Tonight on Point, Boss Tweed, the godfather of corrupt politicians. You can join the conversation. Do we tolerate some shadiness in our politicians as long as they deliver the goods? And is a Boss Tweed just beneath the surface of some politicians today? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Kenneth Ackerman, author of Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. He worked more than 25 years on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch. Kenneth Ackerman currently practices law in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and author of Pauls, Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jennifer. Hello, Mr. Ackerman.
Oh, nice to meet you.
It's nice to have you in the studio, Jack.
Oh,
face
nice
to face
be here.
As opposed to on the phone. This is fun.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Ackerman, your book. We should start for listeners with a sort of visual picture of what Boss Tweed looked like, what kind of a man he was, how he carried himself.
Oh, he was a big man who filled a room. When he walked into a room, all the heads would turn. He was 6 foot tall. He weighed about 300 pounds. He had a swagger in his walk. He had blue eyes, a twinkle in his eye. If you were a friend, he'd come over, pat you on the back, shake your hand, share a joke with you. If you were an enemy, he would give you a glare that could turn you to ice. He wore a shirt front diamond that you mentioned that was valued at about $300,000 in modern money. That's 10.5 carats that some friends gave him as a Christmas present.
You know, maybe it's the company I keep, but I don't actually know how big a 10.5-carat diamond would be.
Well, some people said it looked like a planet on his shirt front. But before you think, it's good to have friends like that. Those were the very people who turned against him when the going got tough.
Oh, the rise and the fall. It's all interconnected. New York in those days would not have been that big a city, and he would have been well-known almost from the beginning. Let's start at his sort of early days. He was a firefighter, but he got involved quite quickly at Tammany Hall, did he not?
That's right. He started out in business. His father was a chairmaker, and he went into a brush-making business on the Lower East Side. And Tweed was a bright young person. He was good at math. He was the bookkeeper at the company. But he was also very popular, big, one of the tough kids on the block, good with his fists, good in a fight. He joined the volunteer firemen because they were the glamorous people in the neighborhood. They were the local heroes then as now. Being a friendly person, they made him their foreman. That was a great way to get into politics. You had a group of about 70 or 80 friends who would turn out and organize a precinct on election day, but were also as tough as any street gang if you needed some muscle behind you also on election day. Tammany came and recruited him in the 1840s when there was an open seat on the Board of Aldermen. Tweed at first declined. He wanted to make money in business. But after a while, seeing the way the city worked, seeing how people who played ball with the politicians got rich very quickly, he decided to jump in. He ran for alderman, finally got elected after two tries. He spent one term in Washington, D.C. in Congress, but found it very boring. At that point in the 1850s, Washington was where they sent you if they wanted to get you out of the way for a while.
he sounds in your book as someone who was just a New York guy.
Yeah.
You know, nowhere else was really going to interest him.
Well, when he was in Washington, he found it boring. He couldn't wait to get back to New York. When he was in the city, He was part of the city. He knew everyone he ran into. He lived his entire life, the first 40 years of his life, within about a 25-block area on the Lower East Side near the East River, near what's now the base of the Williamsburg Bridge. He bragged at one point in 1868 that he knew 9 out of 10 people in New York City. And that's probably not too much of an exaggeration. At that point, New York was only Manhattan Island. It hadn't spread out into Brooklyn and Queens and the other boroughs. And the population, when he was young, was only about 300,000.
Right.
Within his lifetime, it tripled to almost 1 million. And most of those people were crowded into the neighborhoods at the southern tip of New York. When Tweed was growing up, 42nd Street was the outer suburbs.
Well, tell me about his relationship to the Irish immigrant population, because this became in many ways his power base in the early days.
Tweed was a very pragmatic person. He Tammany Hall, which was his political club, had made a pact with the Irish. The Irish backed them, and they gave them a share of power. They appointed many Irishmen to high positions at a time when the prejudice against Catholics and Irish was very sharp in America, and most elite Republican politicians looked down their noses at dealing at all with the unwashed. Tweed became a champion of the Irish. He recognized that he could deal with them as voters. He could, as long as he could deliver the services to them, he could serve as the ombudsman who could get them a job, who could get them a lump of coal at Christmas, who could fix the wheels of government to get them a charity. They came and supported him. It became almost a badge of honor if you were a poor immigrant kid to go out and vote 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 times for the machine, because that was your way to get a job. That was your way to become respectable in society.
When it doesn't sound like a bad deal so far.
Well, it actually wasn't a bad deal. For the immigrants, it was a very good deal. He brought them in. Yes, he used them, certainly, but no more than any other politician uses a constituency group to get elected. The flaw in Tweed's system, as long as it was going, it was good for the poor. It was good for the rich, because he spent lavishly on city improvements. He paved the streets, he laid sidewalks, he dug sewers, he paid for large public works. So property values were going up all over town. The problem was that it was all based on theft. And sooner or later, when you steal, you get caught. In his case, he kept property taxes low. The way he paid for everything, the charity to the poor, the graft for himself, the building for the city, was that he had a system of issuing dozens of different kinds of bonds. There were street improvement bonds, court improvement bonds, reservoir bonds, courthouse bonds. During his few years in power, the city debt literally topped $100 million, which is a gargantuan amount of money for that period of time.
Now, who bought
most of those?
Who bought the bonds?
Most of those bonds he very carefully sold to a combination of Wall Street bankers, who would then sell them around the country, or else to investors in Europe, far from the scene.
Okay.
And a lot of the investors in Europe had recently been burned by manipulators on Wall Street. So buying city bonds from New York, municipal bonds, was considered a lot safer than buying stock in the New York Central Railroad or the Erie Railroad, which were being whipsawed back and forth on Wall Street.
Mm. Do you know, the thing that strikes me as strange about that, though, he was a smart guy, and yet the payment on the debt got astronomically larger every year. I mean, surely he must have seen an end on the horizon, never mind what happened with people spilling the beans.
He never did. He never saw an end on the horizon.
What does that tell us about Tweed?
He was someone who, as long as things were going well, he was happy. He did reach a point where he started to get complacent, and that, in the end, is what brought him down. When the summer of 1871, the year that the New York Times broke the story about his frauds, and also that there was a major riot, a religious riot in New York City, Tweed should have been on the streets, and he probably could have quieted the storm. But instead, that summer, he became very fat and happy at his estate in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tweed owned a... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to bring Jack Beatty into the conversation here. We were talking earlier today about how we felt about Boss Tweed, and I think I like him a little better than you do.
Well, in the end, the poor people of New York had to pay one way or another. They may have gotten momentary gifts, and I'm sure those are important. But, you know, the debate about people like this is really one that David Reisman mentioned, framed years ago. He said, city bosses swam in a gravy we can well afford. His point was that these people provided services, that they did things, that they connected newcomers to cities, immigrants to the nation, that in the absence of any kind of welfare state, they had little mini welfare states, and that, yes, there was gravy, but it was a gravy the rest of the society could well afford. With Tweed, you get to something like a gargantuan heaps and pools of gravy.
You can't see the dumpling for the
gravy.
No,
you can't see the... But in this, he was only distinguished by how, you know, by the lavishness of the scale.
The sheer scale of it.
This
it
sort
is.
Of thing
it's
was
amazing.
Going on all over America. Every state had its boss. Most cities had a boss. Politics was thoroughly corrupt. Vernon Parrington called this era the Great Barbecue. And that's what it was, businessmen bribing politicians to run the government for them and politicians taking that money and giving railroad land grants and favors and so on, and providing the National Guard to suppress strikes.
Oh, Bill Tweed being very much a man of his era. We're going to take a pause here, but we'll be right back. I am speaking today with Kenneth Ackerman. He's the author of Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. And also with us in studio is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst and a writer with Atlantic Monthly. Where am I? Okay. Stay with us. You're listening to On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about New York's Boss Tweed, the godfather of corrupt politicians. You can join the conversation. Where do you think Boss Tweed would be today? In politics? In business? Maybe in jail? If Tweed, instead of Michael Bloomberg, were mayor of New York City, could he make the kind of improvements to the city now that he did back then? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking with Kenneth Ackerman, author of Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. Kenneth Ackerman worked more than 25 years on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch. And with me here in studio is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and author of Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. And, of course, you are with Atlantic Monthly. And the reason I said weekly is because I have Harper's Weekly on my mind. Kenneth Ackerman, let's talk for a minute about the poison in the pen of cartoonist Thomas Nast.
Well, Thomas Nast was a brilliant person. He was the first superstar of visual imagery in America. In the 1860s, the whole notion of mass-produced picture newspapers was almost brand new. The technology had come over from Europe in the 1850s, and with the Civil War, the demand for people to see drawings of the battlefront was enormous. And suddenly, journals like Harper's Weekly, which contained artists' rendering of faces and events in the news, were selling 100, 200, 1,000 copies every week. This was a time before photographs could be copied in newspapers. Photographs existed, but were still very rare. Thomas Nast was the first person to use the power of images and drawing to anything like this kind of political effect. What he did with Boss Tweed was basically turn him into a cartoon character like Bugs Bunny or Elmer Fudd, very recognizable when you'd see him. Every week, Harper's Weekly would contain a cartoon making the boss look evil, menacing, but funny, not fearsome. He would take him down a few notches as someone that you could laugh at rather than cower before.
I didn't know until I read your book that Thomas Nast was also responsible for some other icons in the United States.
Yes, Santa Claus. He's a very sentimental guy.
And the party symbols.
Yes, the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant.
Okay. Now, so he would have, his drawings helped, but of course there was a newspaper involved in this too. And tell us about how the New York Times first started to chip away at the reputation of Bill Tweed.
Well, this was an important time for the American press. Most of the newspapers in New York City, and these were the major, New York was the major media center then as now, most of the newspapers were literally on the take. The New York City spent millions of dollars in advertising and subsidies in order to keep the newspapers friendly. Several editors from major newspapers had sinecure jobs in City Hall. They never showed up for work. They got paychecks while they were editing the New York Herald, one of the biggest newspapers in town, for instance. The New York Times at the time was being run by a man named George Jones, and he basically felt enough was enough. He was an honest man. He was a quiet, soft-spoken person. He had actually been the financial head of the New York Times. Henry Raymond was his partner in forming it. It was Henry Raymond who was the editorial genius of the paper. He had died recently. George Jones was basically a solid Protestant New England straight arrow type person, and he decided to take on Tweed, both because it would sell newspapers, but because he thought it was the right thing to do. And he stuck with it through a lot of harassment. A lot of the kind of harassment that would turn off any person with less backbone. Not only did Tweed and his circle try to buy the New York Times out from under him several times, they offered him bribes if he would get off the trail. Some lawyers working for the city tried to take away the New York Times building. They tried to suppress sales of the New York Times on the streetcars and in trains. They even had tough-looking guys follow him and his editor on dark streets at night. There was physical intimidation as well. Mm. But the New York Times stuck with it. And after about a year, it took a long time to break this case, finally a disgruntled member of Tweed's own ring, one of his compadres who decided that he wasn't getting his share of the loot, got his hands on some purloined ledger books, which showed the amount of fraud going on. And he took it to the New York Times. First, he tried to blackmail Tweed with it, but when that didn't work, he decided he would go and be a good citizen.
Well, no honor among thieves here. I want to open the phones. We have a call here from Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
We're well.
Okay, I kind of jumped in when you were starting to discuss the famous cartoons of Thomas Nast in the Harper's Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an antiquarian print collector and seller from time to time, and over the course of years, many of those marvelous illustrations showing Boss Tweed with his crown and a big throne, and they were really fascinating. I guess these were the early predecessors of our caricatures in political cartoons today.
Right.
And I believe a history of Tweed could be taken right through just watching all of the Nast illustrations. They're marvelous wood engravings, and they're still available for collectors, believe it or not.
Have some of them passed through your hands, Harold?
Absolutely, yeah. And I also had collections from the same Harper's about the Civil War, and other of the very famous artists in America illustrated through there, because it was actually is a bit pre-photography to some degree,
mm-hmm.
or right on the when photography started to come in as a form of illustration in the newspapers. But, yeah, Tweed was very, very in my eye for many years.
Well, it's interesting, those cartoons, because for a lot of us, our image of Boss Tweed is simply from that cartoon. But the other I learned a lot about Thomas Nast from your book, Kenneth, and I did not know about sort of the darker underside to some of his attack on Tweed. The way he depicts the Irish in his drawings is really telling.
Well, Tweed was notorious for his bigotry against Catholics and against Irish. Every one of his
Tweed
drawings,
or you mean Nast?
Nast. Every one of his drawings that shows an Irishman, and he put an Irishman in almost every one of them, would show him with a whiskey bottle, a dark-looking face. Many of the Irishmen look almost like baboons, literally. Menacing, ugly people. He has one very famous one that he drew after a group of a Catholic newspaper criticized him for his bigotry. It's called The American River Ganges. It shows a group of school children sitting on a riverbank. And when you first look at it, they're what look like alligators crawling out of the river.
Oh, right.
But when you look more closely, the alligators are bishops and cardinals wearing their vestments and robes, which Nast has turned into jaws and claws and scales. If you try to follow the history of Boss Tweed through Thomas Nast, it would be a very one-sided history. He's really not, well, he is the progenitor of modern editorial cartoons. He's something more than that. He's a person who took the most effective media of the time and used it to bang people over the head.
Mm.
Someone like Michael Moore has been described as a modern version of Thomas Nast, using the visual media of the movies and trying to turn George Bush into a caricature. Similarly, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth have been compared to Thomas Nast, taking this cartoon character image of John Kerry in Vietnam and driving it home in a very hard-handed kind of overbearing kind of way. So Thomas Nast, well, he was a brilliant artist. You look at the pictures now, they almost all make you laugh. They're so vivid and alive as portrayals, but still they do have a dark side.
What was it? You talked about the ledgers being brought into the New York Times, and it looked like a very boring front page when they reproduced the ledger on it, but I suppose for the people of New York it was fascinating. But this precipitated almost a forensic audit of mm-hmm. the city accounts, and there happened to be one man smart enough to figure all of this out, Samuel Tilden. Tell us a bit about he was so responsible for the bringing down of Boss Tweed.
Well, Samuel Tilden is one of the curious figures of this whole period. He was a very, very smart man. He was a lawyer living in New York City. He came from a political family upstate. He was considered the best railroad lawyer in the East Coast. He represented something like half of the railroads in the 1850s. He made so much money that he was able to build a beautiful mansion on Gramercy Park in New York, which stands today as the National Arts Club. He was the state party chairman, and he did have political ambitions. He was clean as a whistle. There was no scandal attached to him. And he and Tweed had a long enmity. They were always close to each other, but always were gnawing at each other. When the New York Times broke the story of the Tweed ring frauds, what they did was they printed ledger books that showed that an enormous amount of money had been paid by the city that was impossibly large to be justified. For instance, for chairs for the county courthouse, there was enough money spent to buy 315,000 chairs, which would make a line 17 miles long. You would look at that number, and you obviously knew this was fraud. But it was impossible at first to connect that to anyone. Tweed had done such a good job of covering his tracks, of laundering the money. What Tilden did was he managed to get his hands on the books, the account ledgers from one of the banks where Tweed had an account, and also of the city controller's office. And through it, he got a squad, a group of about five or six accountants, and they spent days and days and days going through account ledgers, filling up page after page of ledger sheets, trying to piece together, looking for patterns in these different transactions. In a day before computer spreadsheets, before even typewriters,
Jack
and
Beattie,
they ultimately.
Sorry, I just wanted to bring Jack Beattie in on this. You know, when I hear about that, the number of chairs and whatnot, and this huge inflated amount. Obviously, they didn't need that many. What springs to my mind is the famous toilet at the Pentagon and what the military has spent for things over the years. I mean, you know, 1871 sometimes doesn't seem all that long ago.
No, not at all. I mean, the padding that goes into government contracts is notorious then and now. I guess people say, you know, there's a tendency to deal with corruption in the past as if, oh, that sordid episode, that's how people were then. And what we forget, to get back to this David Reisman point, the gravy these guys were in was gravy some people benefited by. The gravy our current politicians are in PAC money, up until yesterday, soft money, we don't benefit by. In point of fact, we get hurt by. The bankruptcy bill just passed is going to hurt most any American who may need to, you know, someone with medical expenses, for example, who may need to go bankrupt. This bankruptcy bill is going to make it harder for that person to get shuck of his debt. That was paid for by private. That's gravy in our politicians, but we it actually hurts most Americans. Mm. That's the difference. The corruption today is systemic, and people, most people, don't benefit from it. Most people are really hurt by it.
Right. But Kenneth Ackerman, when we look at the fallout after the New York Times, I know that there. I'm skipping through a lot here, but there were the trials. There were several, and when you get right down to it, wasn't the ring, which was four men, Boss Tweed being one of them, was it not Boss Tweed the only one who ended up doing any prison time for any of this?
Yes, he was the only one.
I think that's unfair.
Well, you're not alone. Most people alive then, I mean, we forget this. Everyone remembers Boss Tweed by the Thomas Nast cartoon, so we forget this. But at the time, when Boss Tweed died in jail, most people considered him a martyr and a victim of selective prosecution and prosecutorial abuse. He was the only one of the Tweed ring, with a few small exceptions, to serve any substantial time in jail. He was convicted of 204 counts of misdemeanor fraud. That sounds like a lot, but it was one indictment. The law at the time said that one indictment meant one penalty, 1 year. Mm-hmm. The judge decided to change the rules for this one trial and make it 12 years. After Tweed spent a year and a half on Blackwell's Island Penitentiary, that's on what we now call Roosevelt Island in the East River,
right.
They got the sentence overturned by the Court of Appeals. After that, Tweed was held without trial, basically on default of a multimillion-dollar bail imposed in a civil case. They never brought him to trial again. The reason was that the whole justice system, the New York State prosecutorial apparatus, was being run at the time by Samuel Tilden, who was running for president. And every prosecutor, every judge involved in pursuing the Tweed case was somehow getting a benefit. One of them was elected to Congress. Another became the chief judge in the state. And you know, everyone got some reward for it. People built their careers on keeping Tweed in jail. That's how they justified their reputations as reformers.
One of the stories that you tell when he was on Blackwell Island, and this just spoke volumes to me about the kind of personality he must have had, they made him an orderly in the hospital, and he won them over. I mean, he won the inmates over while he was there.
Yeah, there's a very touching story on his second Christmas at the Blackwell's Island Penitentiary, after he'd been there quite a while. They served a very nice Christmas dinner, but Tweed was bigger than everyone. He was overweight. Everyone knew that. He was suffering from diabetes. Several of the inmates gave up their Christmas dinner so that they could serve him seconds.
So that Boss Tweed could have an even larger Christmas dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Something else in the book that I didn't know, and I don't know why, I just assumed this, he was not a smoker and not a big drinker.
Right. His vice was that he liked to eat.
He loved his food, and it showed.
Yes. In a way, if he lived today and had a modern doctor, he would have done much better. If he had worked out a little bit and exercised, he'd have a very different persona. When he was growing up, he was a tough person. He was a fireman. He was in good physical shape, but he made a point to go to one of the better city steakhouses every day for lunch and have a couple of glasses of wine with a good meal. He hired one of the best chefs in town to work at City Hall for days that he couldn't get out. He threw one wedding in his house for one of his daughters, who married a man from New Orleans, where he just broke all the records. He had the kitchen staff at Delmonico's restaurant, the most famous restaurant in the city at the time, work an entire week to put together this very elaborate dinner. It turned out that the guests at the wedding, who were mostly city contractors and city officials, gave her what in modern money would be about $15 million in presents.
I have such a hard time processing that, because I know in 1871 that would have been just as astronomical a sum it sounds for wedding gifts. I mean, then it must have, I can't even get my head around it.
Yes, it was, there was just a room full of diamonds and gems and silver, and at that point, even Tweed's supporters started to realize that he had gone overboard. He had lost touch.
Yes, even that was excessive by Tweed standards. We're going to take a short pause here. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're discussing New York's boss Tweed and the example he set and shouldn't have for all politicians. Do you think politics is really that much cleaner than it was more than a century ago? Do you think maybe we tolerate some shadiness in our politicians as long as they deliver the goods? The roads, the courthouses, the Brooklyn bridges that we need. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Boss Tweed, the godfather of corrupt politicians. Do you feel as if we're reliving the era of Boss Tweed, with many on society's bottom rung and just a few who hold on to all the power? Is this another time when the ends seem to justify the political means? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Kenneth Ackerman, author of Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. And with me in the studio is Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and author of Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. I'd like to go back to the phones. We have a caller from Derry, New Hampshire. Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, hi. How's it going, Jennifer?
So far, so good.
Good. I've got to say, I love the topic. I did a report on Tweed back in ninth grade, and as a former native of Providence, Rhode Island, I'm very well familiar with the having a semi-crooked politician in charge of a city. Buddy Cianci there was well-known and revered for his ties to many of the underhanded bosses of the city.
This is a former mayor of Providence?
Former mayor of Providence. And he got stuff done. He knew that the most important thing he could do was make sure everybody was happy. And as long as he and his people took a little taste for themselves and weren't too greedy about it, no one minded. Things happened. You know, the city was greatly improved while he was there.
Kenneth Ackerman, that's something you talk about in your book as honest graft.
Mm-hmm. I think the caller is exactly on point. We in America will put up with corruption in politics as long as our politicians deliver the goods. And you could come up with dozens of examples of that. Everything from the fact that Bill Clinton was popular through the end, even with his moral lapse with Monica Lewinsky, because he managed the government well. At the end of his term, more people thought, or at least according to many polls, but most people thought that Kent Starr was the villain and not the president. We've seen the same with Marion Barry here in Washington, D.C. He was run out of city government. He was convicted of cocaine abuse, and now he's back as an alderman, elected by the people because he delivered the goods. That happens time and time again. Politicians, there was a political fixer in Tammany Hall named George Washington Plunkett in 1905 who said, you know, the critics say that politicians get rich while serving the people. Well, what of it?
Jack Beattie, I'd like to bring you in on this point as well, the idea that we're willing to tolerate a certain amount. And I guess each generation sets its limits on what it's going to tolerate.
Yeah, and it's not a good thing that we tolerate it on the whole, it seems to me, because it degrades the democracy. I said that Vernon Parrington called the era after the Civil War the Great Barbecue. You could also call it the Great Disappointment, because after a war that had at its heart a transcendent moral purpose to cleanse American history of this, the sin of slavery, and after 600,000 people had died in that struggle, not all for that cause, only half, after that high note, the rest of the era was a low, sordid plunge, deeper and deeper and deeper. Mm-hmm. At the time that the Tweed business was going on, the President of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant, presided over the most crapulent government probably up until Richard Nixon's. His wife may have been in some way corrupt. People never knew about that. His private secretary was one of the most corrupt people in the country. His Secretary of the Interior was ripping off Indian reservations and coming back with all that sorts of money. His Attorney General had caparisoned himself in regalia, had spent thousands for a carriage, had given his wife money for parties. Grant's two vice presidents were both implicated in the Credit Mobilier scandal. And in St. Louis, through all of these years, there was something called the Whiskey Ring, which was a way in which whiskey distillers and politicians got away from paying the whiskey tax and had hundreds of thousands of dollars, which they dispersed to Republican office holders all over the country. This was the sordid low point of American politics, and against that background, Tweed was the norm.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to the phones here. Peter, you're calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program. Peter, are you there?
Absolutely.
There you go.
Let's not forget that today, our sitting president has a brother who defaulted on a $5 million SBA loan while paying himself $1 million a year salary to head an oil and gas company, was on the board of directors of Silverado. Remember Reagan signing that bill? I think we've hit a gold mine here. That one bank was responsible for more than 10% of all the taxpayer bailout for the SNLs. It's going on now. It's just there's not really so many laborers involved. It seems like the connected business people. Enron, was it Ralph Reed who was working for them during the campaign? Or getting paid more in a month than I will make this year.
But he's also a godly young man, so be very careful.
Well, I'm sure his background well merited the salary with his expertise. Now it's just they call it business. Especially if you're from Texas.
Enron is an interesting thing to bring up. We were talking about that earlier in the day, whether that might not be the better comparison, you know, the sort of ring at the top of a corporation, just like the ring at the top of New York City used to be. Go ahead, Kenneth.
The comparison between you had pondered earlier, mentioned what would Tweed be doing if he were alive today? Would he be in politics or would he be in business? And I picture him very much in business because someone like Tweed, someone who's that dynamic, he's someone who would want to be in control of anything he did. And I think he would chafe at the bureaucracy of being a mayor or being a governor or even being a senator or a congressman today. He would want to have unfettered power if he could do it. I picture him more as a Warren Buffett or as a business leader. But when you look at the corruption in corporations over the last few years, Enron, WorldCom, the list goes on and on. It's a very cold-blooded kind of corruption. It's almost stealing for its own sake. And in those cases, Jack was making the point about how at least Tweed was doing something with his power. He was doing something useful with his power. Enron created offshore accounts to hide losses to make a false impression on Wall Street, and as a result, millions of people lost savings. Thousands lost their retirements. Thousands lost their jobs. The fallout was much worse in many ways than what Boss Tweed did. Even correcting for the inflation between 1870 and 2000.
I want to see if we can squeeze another call in here. Russell is calling from Carbo, North Carolina. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing well.
Nice to hear your show. What?
Sorry.
Hello?
Great. Can you hear me? Go ahead.
Yes. I was just going to say that typically in power politics, it all comes down to my crook is better than your crook. And when the ethics go so far off the board that nobody's crook is acceptable, there is a revolution, and people mm-hmm. throw those people out of power. Grant is one of my great heroes because he was such a great human, and if it hadn't been for his work in prosecuting the Civil War, we would not have the democracy that we have as a unified people with our disunity. I think if I was going to ask anybody what they would have to say about crookedness, I would ask Jared Diamond, who has written some wonderful books about the process of civilization and government, mm-hmm. and points us towards an understanding of the great drama that is being undertaken in our world today in terms of geopolitics.
Kenneth Ackerman, what do we have to learn from Boss Tweed for today, for 2005?
Well, a couple of things. Well, there's the obvious, thou shalt not steal, and when you steal, you ultimately get caught. But also, Boss Tweed, to me, the reason I was attracted to him as a person, as someone to write about, was that he's someone who had a dynamic about him. He had a core of integrity. He showed that even if you blunder badly through your whole life, and in a lot of ways he did through his crimes, his stealing, his graft, he's someone who managed to keep to own up to it at the end. After he was in jail for a couple of years, he broke out of jail at one point. He managed to sneak away from the Ludlow Street jail where he was being held. He made it as far as Cuba and then to Spain, only to be rearrested and dragged back home. At that point, he made a deal with the prosecutors that if he would give a full confession of all of his crimes, of everything he did, that they would let him free. They would let him die at home. And Tweed carried out his end of the bargain. He spent 11 days talking in public before a committee of aldermen in New York City, detailing with no apologies, no excuses, no hiding, no hiding behind technicalities. He laid out exactly how he bribed the state legislature, how he skimmed contracts, how he got money from the Treasury, how he manipulated the voting booth, all of the things that he did. Most of what we know from the Tweed wing, we know from his own words.
Right,
his transcript covers over 500 pages.
And then after all that, he ended up being double-crossed. That's all we have time for, Kenneth Ackerman. They're going to have to go and buy your book. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Oh, my pleasure, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
We've been talking tonight with Kenneth Ackerman, the author of Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. And also joining us in studio, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst from Atlantic Monthly. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a surprise Republican defection puts President Bush's nominee for UN ambassador in limbo. This is On Point. Today, the White House is not backing down in efforts to get John Bolton approved as the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. White House spokesman Scott McClellan accused Democrats of fabricating charges and making unfound allegations against the embattled nominee. Those comments come a day after a scheduled vote on Bolton was delayed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at a bitterly contentious meeting. Here's an excerpt from remarks made by Democratic Senator Joseph Biden.
In your heart, you know this guy doesn't deserve to go to the UN. In your heart, you know that to be true. All right, follow this time. Follow your heart, not your head. Follow your heart on here, because your head's going to tell you to be really practical and don't screw around with the president's nominee.
The meeting came to a surprising halt when Republican Senator George Voinovich from Ohio suggested he was not comfortable voting for Bolton. Keeping a watchful eye on all of this is Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Welcome, Gail.
Thanks, Jennifer. Good to be here.
Sometimes these committees just drone on, and sometimes they don't. Set the scene for us. How did all this passionate rhetoric get started?
Well, it was passionate right from the beginning when it became clear that Senator Lugar was going to move the chairman of the committee quickly to a vote. Democrats wanted to delay it. It was preceded by some very interesting procedural maneuvers. Harry Reid, the minority leader, pulled out a procedural objection that's almost never used that says that a committee can't meet while the Senate is in session. Senator Frist, the majority leader, quickly responded by putting the Senate into recess so that this committee could vote this nomination to the floor. When he walked into the meeting, Senator Lugar, who I spoke to this afternoon, was convinced he had 10 votes until Senator Voinovich spoke up and said, "I'm not with you on this." It was a great surprise.
Well, now, he came late to the process, did he not, in these committee hearings?
Well, he had actually missed the hearings the week before. And given how high-profile they were, Senator Lugar expected he would have read them or something. But he really apparently was picking up what he knew about it from the hearing, and he didn't like what he was hearing from Democrats. Say, Senator Biden, the ranking Democrat, started right away talking about the new allegations that the committee had heard and not had a chance to run down, some of them quite vivid,
mm-hmm.
You know, harassing a AID worker in a Moscow hotel room, beating on her door, you know, running after her, later misrepresenting her legal problems that she didn't have to colleagues. You know, it's just the kind of very challenging stuff that you'd certainly like to have corroborated before you put out in a public setting. Senator Biden's intent was to go into a closed session to release all of this, but Senator Lugar really wanted that vote. And right up until Voinovich's comment, he thought he had it.
Well, so one Republican that we know of having doubts, at least. Where does the committee now stand?
They've given themselves about 3 weeks, next week and then a recess, and then they'll come back. And in that period, the Democrats are going to work with the chairman to run down some of these allegations, call new witnesses if needed, and even call Mr. Bolton back to answer questions.
What happens in this case, Gail, if there's a tie?
If there's a tie, nothing moves out of committee.
Is that a rule?
The nomination could move to the floor. That is a rule.
Okay.
It could move to the floor with a positive recommendation, with no recommendation, or unusually, with a negative recommendation. But it doesn't move unless it has a majority.
It doesn't. Go ahead.
With one defecting Republican, they don't have that.
Okay. It doesn't look at this point either like the White House is willing to withdraw any support from its nominee.
No. No, they see this as playing out the kind of bitter partisanship that has gone on in Washington. Ray, and it's, you know, for someone like Senator Lugar, who's one of the most traditional of senators, very courtly in his manner, the hearing was especially disappointing because he had wanted to see a debate about the United Nations. That's what usually happens when you take up someone who's being considered as an ambassador, talk about the problems with the institution. But instead, this one very quickly segued to the nominee's apparent arrogant treatment of subordinates and now, you know, harassment, possibly misrepresenting some things in his testimony.
And some of those larger issues about the UN are not what is attracting focus these days.
That's right.
Right. Okay, Gail, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.